and that you're interested in my beginnings. And I have this distinction that I really belonged to the last century. It was always a source of great delight to my children and grandchildren when we mentioned the fact that I was born before the turn of the century. Actually, my birthday was December 18th, 1897. And at that happened also to be the first candle of Hanukkah that year, so that all through my growing years, I had the added privilege of celebrating both Hanukkah and my birthday at the same time. My family was a relatively small one. My father, my mother, one brother, and two sisters. The home was a happy one. There was a good deal of laughter. There was a good deal of singing, because my father was a great lover of music. He also was not above doing a little dance when he walked across the floor, for which I realized we had much to be thankful. My mother's family never permitted itself such informalities. They were austere, a rather solemn bunch, which made a perhaps good combination. My father was Nathan Adlow. He said that the name was spelled by the registration official who took him, who interviewed him when he landed in Ellis Island. And when he asked him his name, he said he told him his name, which was Adler. And the man wrote it A-D-L-O-W. And so it remained. As a matter of fact, destiny has played a strange trick on us, because there are no young male descendants in the Adlow line. And just my sister, who retained her maiden name all through her professional career, was known as Miss Adlow. Now, to get back to those first years, I was born on the wrong side of Beacon Hill. When I say the wrong side, I mean it was the side on which Santayana did not live, and nor did the Cabots and the Joneses. It was the side on which a Jewish population was beginning to cluster. I think it was Chambers Street, but I have no recollections of that very first period, because my family moved to East Boston. And there I do have my first recollection, when I was about 3 years old, sitting on the front steps of a gray clapboard house which had a picket fence around it. And I sat there waiting for the important events of my life, which centered around my brother, who played on the street, rolling a hoop or playing ball. He was only 16 months older than I. Nevertheless, he seems to have been a very rugged and robust youngster. And when my father came home from the end of his day's work, he would tie up his horse to the hitching post, which was set on the curbstone, and he would come in and generally pick me up in his arms and call my brother, and we would go inside. And after he would cluck happily at my baby sister, who was in a crib, he and my brother would go to take the horse to the stable around the corner to finish off his day.
What did your father do, Lillian?
He was a customer peddler. You've heard that before. That was, by the way, that was not a beginning. That was a pretty healthy way up the ladder of success. The story of his beginning, perhaps I should tell you right now and not go back to it later. My father came to America in 1887. The reason I remember that date so well is because one of his fondest recollections had to do with the great blizzard of 1888. When my father came to this country, he had just about nothing. There was $25 in his pocket, but it wasn't his. It was given to him for, it was necessary for admission into Ellis Island for an immigrant to have $25. And as he said, after it had done its job for him, he had to send it back to the old country so that someone else could come with that $25. He came to live with an aunt and uncle about 10 years older than himself. And they were always very warm and cordial, and they made him feel at home. But they had no money either. Somebody taught him how to repair an umbrella with the ribs of a broken umbrella. And then he was taught to walk through the street and shout, "Umbrellas to mend, umbrellas to mend." And strangely, at the end of the day, he had earned $2. This really started him in business. And with the $2, he bought a few wooden seats to nail onto kitchen chairs. And he added to his earnings until he had about $10. And then he went to one of the wholesale stores in the north end of Boston, probably Salem Street, and he bought what they called a basket of notions. Notions being thimbles, needles, buttons, thread, pins, and things of that sort, which he carried and knocked on doors and peddled to people. One of the classic stories in our family life had to do with the day that he knocked on a door and a woman opened who looked somewhat friendly. And he said, "Is you a Jew?" And she slammed the door in his face. But he wasn't completely disheartened. He went on to the next door. And after enough of this, he saved up enough money to buy a horse. Now, this was a very important transition in his economic history because it made him a businessman. However, he always told us that the man who sold him the horse was a dirty, no good thief. And I'm afraid that horse traders have had a bad reputation, because that first horse was bony and balky and most of the time didn't want to go. But it was a part of my father's education, and eventually he did use his horse and his little wagon, and they carried his merchandise out into the suburbs of Boston, where the women who were not in the habit of going into the city to shop were glad to see the peddler come with his rolls of cotton goods and flannel and other simple merchandise. And so he could come to them week after week, and they purchased from him. It must have been a good relationship, because he often told us about the wonderful old woman who offered him warm milk to drink. And I thought that was a nice gesture. Eventually, this customer peddling, which was very common, by the way, among the immigrants, they subsequently became the little storekeepers. They opened up stores wherever it was convenient, and retail merchants. And my uncle, who lived with us at that time also, Uncle Abe, who was a bachelor, indeed he never married, was an important member of our family, he also was a customer peddler, but he had none of my father's joy of living. He was very austere, but he was apparently thrifty and good businessman, and eventually he gave up his customer peddling and opened a clothing store in Hanover Street in Boston. I shan't go into all the details about my uncle. He was an interesting character. The most important thing I remember about him was that he had a book which was a compendium of manners. And we saw pictures of ladies with little hats and bustles in the back of their dresses and little muffs and skirts that swept the ground, and gentlemen with tall hats and and long flowing coats. And also in this book were instructions on a fine writing hand. And we would often find pieces of paper in Uncle Abram's room with ovals, which he had painstakingly made over and over and over again, and did eventually develop quite a nice writing hand, much better than my father's, which was purely functional. Nobody ever taught my father. He just taught himself. And he always scratched when he wrote. We knew that Papa was busy at his books when we heard the scratching of his pen. But I mustn't take time for all of these little details. You want to hear more. Of course, you know, in 1897, my birthday in December, and that carried me through the years of the Spanish War. So, of course, I heard the songs of the Spanish War when my father was rocking me to sleep and when he would carry me in his arms. I'm sure you wouldn't remember. Spain, 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 you ought to be ashamed to blow up the Maine in 1898. Did you ever hear that?
Never.
Yes, well, I did. That was one of my father's songs. And, of course, he loved to dance. And with his big, heavy boots, he would carry me in his arms, and he would dance around the room to the tune of After the Ball Was Over. After, oh, I'm sure your father would remember that. After the break of day,
I remember that.
Many's the heart was broken. And I don't remember that more after that. And, of course, East Side, West Side, All About the Town. Those were the songs on which we were brought up. And he had the zip and the zest and the fun to give them to us, too. And I know that we were very lucky to have that atmosphere in the house. But, of course, we couldn't go on forever. Although we had many guests and visitors who were newcomers, the times were changing. And when my uncle opened a retail clothing store in the center of town, my father began to think about some kind of a business. And by 1902, he had decided to open a furniture store in Roxbury, which was at the other end of town. And that necessitated radical changes in our lives because he would now take on a new form of slavery to the economic style of the New World. When you had a store, it was very different from when you were an independent operator. When my father was a peddler, he didn't work on Saturday. He came home early on Friday. And on Saturday he walked the long distance from East Boston home to the Baldwin Place Shul. And they used to cross the ferry, the East Boston ferry, and which was as I tell you this, I can smell the dank salt water smell and the old piles standing by the edge of the water. But when he opened his store in Roxbury, it necessitated a new, completely changed life. We moved from East Boston to Roxbury, which at that time, well, it was variegated. There was one side of Roxbury Street was industrial and poor, and it was marked by labor difficulties, frequent strikes, and the impoverished people lived in these little tenements, these brick tenements, three stories high. On the other side of Roxbury Street, moving its way up the hill and through several long streets, Roxbury Street, Dudley Street, Warren Street, up to past Joseph Warren House. You're not familiar with Boston, so this wouldn't mean very much to you. But there were nice streets with trees, not great big houses, nice houses with picket fences around most of them and some gardens. And there began to be occasional brick apartments, and there were, of course, quite a number of churches, Protestant churches. But as the few years went on, we saw changes. There were more Catholic churches began to appear, and eventually Jewish synagogues in Roxbury. And you know, a day came when Roxbury was practically all Jewish. And of course, I don't have to tell you that now it's no longer all Jewish, it's all black. But that was just the cycle of history moving on. Now, it's always a temptation to me to tell you too many things. When we lived in the first house we lived in Roxbury, I used to walk to school, and I passed the house where a white-haired old man sat on a porch, and his name was Edward Everett Hale. And we passed on the corner of Elliott Square, this old church, where originally the famous colonial preacher, Elliot, had preached to the Indians at that particular spot. The old church still stood there, on the and the old Norfolk House, which was, an inn that was occupied, was used by travelers who came by the Boston Post Road, by coach from New York to Boston, and it was the last stopover before they went into the city of Boston. And this old building still stood there, and on the sidewalk there was a stone watering trough for horses. And beside that was also a pipe arrangement for drinking water for humans with a tin cup fastened by a chain. It was before we were quite as germ conscious as we are now. I remember when the big public campaign arose in 1915, Boston 1915 it was called, and we were to do away with all public drinking cups. Some do-gooders, of course, decided that they must help save society. Well, again, as I said, I must leave all of these tidbits, which intrigued me very much, but will take too much time, and remind you that as these years passed, we did acquire several new members of the family. It was my brother Eli with me. We were both already going to school. My sister Dorothy, who was 4 years younger than I, and eventually my sister Chippy, who was 3 years younger than Dorothy. I, of course, was the eldest girl, and I must say that it was taken for granted that the eldest girl should have some sense of responsibility about the other children. I seem to remember that when I was about 8, it would never have entered my mind to play with dolls, although I did get some kind of secret pleasure out of providing dolls for my younger sister and helping put them to sleep and do all the things that little girls like to do. But, of course, I would never have admitted that I was doing it for myself. It was because it was for the younger children. I very early became a reader, and we stopped at the public library to pick up books on Fridays to bring home to read at home. We didn't stay in the apartment. It was an apartment on Cedar Street where we first lived, because it was obviously too small. And we not only had our 4 children by that time, but a sister of my father's came to live with us. That was Aunt Dora. And a sister of my mother, Aunt Libby, in addition to my Uncle Abe. This made quite an establishment. And not surprisingly, my mother and father rented a little house on Kettleworth Street, which was nearer to the center of things in Roxbury. And it was an old house. The ceilings were rather low. There was a Franklin grate fireplace in the parlor, as we called it. It was a white marble, circular fireplace. And the report was that it had been brought to this country by some relative of George Washington. And the house went back to that period. The kitchen had had an iron kitchen stove installed in it. There was a cold pantry, and it really was cold, off the kitchen. And in the autumn, my mother ordered certain basic foods from a farmer, and he brought several barrels of apples and I don't know how many burlap bags of potatoes and onions. There were a number of large pumpkins and squashes. I remember them sitting on the shelves in that pantry. And because it was so cold, things were kept well. They even bought beets in bulk at that time. And my mother also ordered a large box of prunes and other things that could be kept for the winter. There was no such thing as running to the store every little while to buy. She bought as many things as she could in advance. And Boston winters were cold, and we needed, of course, there was a good supply of wood and coal. And in the dining room, there was a little round pot-bellied stove with isinglass windows in the door. And upstairs, in the three or four bedrooms up there, there were little pot-bellied stoves in every room. Now, those all had to be fed and stoked and taken care of.
With and wood or coal?
Well, both. You'd start the fire with wood, and then you'd put on the coal. But it was quite an ordeal. Very early in my life, Jimmy became an important member of the family. Jimmy worked for my father. He was an Irishman with a heavy Irish brogue, and he would drive a horse and wagon up to our house and put in the supply of wood for my mother in the kitchen and a coal scuttle full, you know that word, scuttle?
Mm-hmm.
Full of coal. And if it was needed again later in the day, my father would do it when he would come in. And these were the basics of keeping the house warm. And they were real cold winters. But I don't remember that we felt cold in the house. We were busy, and these...
And encased in heavy woolen underwear.
Oh, of course. Long underwear. And we would sit around the stove, and that was a very important focus for our lives. Now, that is a great temptation to stop to tell you about the year we lived in the yellow house. It was rendered significant because my mother had an accident. She was climbing up on a chair to get something in the kitchen closet, and her skirt caught on the shelf of the black stove, and the shelf, it was a removable shelf, and it fell, and it banged her shin bone. And in a day or two, it was obvious that it was infected and that she needed medical attention. My father, a young and not very knowing member of the community, went out to look for a doctor. He had no telephone in the house. And he found the sign, a doctor's sign on the house. And he asked Dr. Fountain to come to see my mother. And Dr. Fountain did come to see her. And he realized that she would have to stay in bed. So my aunts and my father brought a bed downstairs and set it up in the living room. And my mother, from that point on, managed the household affairs from her bed in the living room. The baby's crib was also brought downstairs. The infected leg had to be operated on, and Dr. Fountain brought a colleague of his, and they My mother was laid on the dining room table, and he operated on her leg. He must have done a good job of it. It healed very well. She always had these two scars on her knee, on her shin. And, as I said, it was one of those classical moments in a family that you never quite forget. But,
Did you all stand around and watch?
No. Dr. Fountain brought gumdrops for all the children. And afterwards he told us this was his first patient.
Oh, my.
You see why we remembered it?
Oh, my goodness.
Well, I must hurry on because...
Okay.
It was decided to move once again, this time to a more modern apartment where the heating system was what's called steam heat, with the big iron radiators that used to clank and make their noises, especially in the morning when things were being stoked up. But it was, of course, a tremendous improvement. It was a large 9-room apartment on one floor with a corridor running down the middle like a spinal column. It was on the 3rd floor, the top floor. And on one side of the spinal column were 5 bedrooms. On the other side was a large front parlor with double doors leading into the back parlor, with double doors leading into the dining room. Then came a kitchen, a large kitchen, and at the end of the corridor, an oak-lined bathroom. That was the one bathroom for the house. The bedrooms were all reasonably sized, and our parents occupied the largest, and there was a big brass bed in it, and it had chiffonier, dresser, table, and chairs, and a crib for the baby. Uncle Abe had the large front room. He sort of reigned in his quiet way, and the girls shared their room with there were 2 rooms with the aunts, and my brother had his own room, small one. It was a spacious, comfortable room, and we realized that we were very lucky to have it. It was in the 8 or 9 years during which we occupied the house on Warren Place that we also got a good deal of our education in living not only with each other, but with our neighbors. I wonder if this is a moment for me to tell you about a few of the other families on Warren Place. There were 2 or 3 Jewish families. One of them was Hungarian Jewish family, and they didn't speak Yiddish. And my mother and father didn't speak Hungarian. So there wasn't a great deal of communication, the English of both being somewhat limited. In addition to which, we gathered that the Holtzes didn't have very much Jewish education.